Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
Marshall John Fisher is an ambitious writer. In his new book, A Terrible Splendor, Three Extraordinary Men, A World Poised for War, and The Greatest Tennis Match Ever Played, he recounts the story of the Davis Cup confrontation between Don Budge and Germany's Baron Gottfried von Kramm. The stakes were considerable, and each player was at or near his peak. When Budge finally emerged victorious in the fifth set, no less an authority than Bill Tilden, who was helping to coach the German team, called the match the greatest of all time. But Fisher also delves into such subjects as Hitler's rise to power and the similarity between the attitudes toward homosexuals and homosexual tennis players in particular in Germany and in the U.S. 60 years ago. When we spoke this week, I began by asking Marshal John Fisher to provide some background on Baron Gottfried von Kramm.
Yes, well, any tennis fans in the 1930s certainly knew of him. He was probably the most popular player in the mid-1930s and clearly the number two player in the world for several years. Von Kramm was a German aristocrat who had grown up in a beautiful estate near Hanover and from a very early age had fallen in love with tennis and had followed his dream and become a French champion twice and was just one of the great players of his time.
It's impossible to fully appreciate Gottfried von Kramm without understanding his commitment to sportsmanship. Please tell the story of his gesture at the point where the German team looked as if it might get further than they ever had before in Davis Cup competition, because that gesture certainly illustrates that commitment.
Yes. Even at the time of when my book takes place, 1937, Germany still had never even reached the challenge round, which was the final round. At that time, the defending champion only had to play one match against the winner of all the challengers. So Germany several times had gotten to the what's called the interzone final, which is the last match before the challenge round. Mm-hmm. That's the match being played in my book. But 2 years before that, they were also playing against the Americans in the interzone final. It really came down to the doubles match, if you work it out. Clearly, at that time, von Kramm clearly was going to win his two singles matches, and they had won. They needed one more match. The Davis Cup ties are the best of five matches. So if they won the doubles, they were certainly going to win and advance to the challenge round. And in that doubles match, von Kramm and his partner, he had a much weaker partner named Kai Lund, but von Kramm was playing so magnificently against the famous American team of Wilmer Allison and John Van Rijn that they reached match point five times. And this was a point that if they won would have given them match point. Mm-hmm. It clearly seemed they had won the point. The ball that the Americans hit went out. The umpire even declared point, and it was match point for Germany. But von Kramm calmly walked up to the umpire and quietly told him that the ball had tipped his racket and that they had, in fact, lost the point. And, no one could believe it. But, of course, the German captain was enraged afterwards, but von Kramm calmly informed him that that's the way he had always played the game, and that's the way he always would.
He said he could not possibly have slept that night if he hadn't told the umpire what had happened.
Yeah. That's right. And so he was famous all around the world for his sportsmanship, and the English press dubbed him the Gentleman of Wimbledon.
The subtitle of your book is Three Extraordinary Men, A World Poised for War and The Greatest Tennis Match Ever Played. The third of the extraordinary men, the first two being Don Budge and Gottfried von Kramm, is Bill Tilden. How did you decide to allow Tilden, who was helping to coach the German Davis Cup team in 1937, to become such a big part of your story?
Yeah, well, Bill Tilden is really the man who started this book off in my mind, because I was looking around for ideas and I thought about Bill Tilden, who was just a fascinating character. He was, at that time, by far, without question, the greatest tennis player ever. He had dominated tennis throughout the 1920s, as no one ever has since. And he was also a fascinating character. He was a homosexual at a time when no one could even talk about that publicly. He, you know, clearly was in the closet, as most homosexuals were at that time. And he rose to the tops, not only of his profession, but really, he was probably the most famous athlete in the world in the 1920s, or certainly one of the few most famous athletes. As I was looking into him, I discovered that Frank DeFord had written a wonderful biography of him. So what I had been thinking of doing, a biography of Tilden that had already been done. But there was, but there was something I read in that bio that struck me, and it mentioned that he had been coaching the German Davis Cup team during this famous Davis Cup final. And I had always read about the Budge von Kram match growing up playing tennis. You know, it was in all the books as one of the great matches of all time. But I had never known that Tilden had been coaching the Germans. And I thought, well, that's really interesting. You know, at that time, the Nazis were deporting homosexuals to the concentration camps and murdering them. And here they had as their coach an American homosexual. That was interesting. And then I started researching about von Kram, and he just became this incredibly fascinating character to me. And I started reading how that after this match, he had been imprisoned on what a lot of sources call trumped up charges of homosexuality. And I thought, huh, that's interesting. And as I researched him more, it became clear that he was a homosexual. They may have imprisoned him anyway, but they didn't have to make up these charges. Homosexuality was illegal. So now this became just very interesting to me that the Nazi team had as its star a homosexual and as its coach a gay American. And, you know, von Kram was being held up as the great Aryan athlete. He was tall and handsome, blonde and blue-eyed, and the perfect German athlete. But in fact, he wasn't quite what the Nazis were portraying him as.
Shortly before that 1937 Davis Cup match, which stands at the center of your book, Don Budge had beaten von Kram for the Wimbledon singles title. You would think that Budge would have won over the English fans by so doing, but when the two men next faced each other for the Davis Cup, von Kram was the crowd favorite. Why?
Yes, he was clearly the favorite, and it had nothing to do with Budge. Budge was very popular in England. But compared to von Kram, I mean, von Kram was still a favorite around the globe and certainly in England. But there was also a second reason why the English were cheering so vociferously for von Kram, and that is that England were the defending champion, which is why the matches were being played at Wimbledon. But they did not have that strong a team this year. Their great champion, Fred Perry, who had led them to victory the previous 3 years, had gone pro. And I should mention that at this time, all of the big tennis tournaments and the Davis Cup were amateur. That includes Wimbledon and the U.S. Championships. All the glory was with the amateurs. And once you turned pro, you couldn't compete in any of these. So this year, the English had a relatively weak team, and it seemed very unlikely they could win it again. But fans figured that they had a better chance against Germany. The Americans were just so strong with Don Budge and with the great doubles team of Budge and Gene Mako. So they didn't seem to have any chance against the Americans, and they didn't think there would be any chance of them getting to face the Germans. But as it turned out, this interzone final had come down to the final match, von Kram and Budge. And yeah, they didn't think von Kram had much of a chance because he had lost pretty badly in the Wimbledon final to Budge. But they were cheering loudly for von Kram. And as the match became very, very close, it seemed like they might have a chance.
It certainly can be argued that von Kram was under more pressure than Don Budge was when they played that match. In fact, the German said to Bill Tilden at one point that he was playing for his life. Was that an overstatement?
Maybe not. In fact, as things turned out, it probably was not an overstatement. The Nazis had made it clear to him that they were following him. They had a big file on von Kram. They had brought him into questioning at least once to Gestapo headquarters. Several sources say that they had made it clear to him that as long as he kept winning, and certainly if he brought Germany the Davis Cup, they wouldn't bother him. I mean, I don't think they could have if Germany had won the Davis Cup. But that if he stopped being useful to them by winning, that he could be in trouble. Germany was not a safe place for homosexuals at that time.
The match ends with an exceptionally acrobatic return from Don Budge, a shot that von Kram could only watch as it went by him at the net. Please read the passage from your book that describes what happens after that final point.
For a second, the gallery can't believe the match is over. Then it explodes. The match had been, quote, something so close to art, in James Thurber's view, that at the end it was more as if a concert had ended than a tennis match. The shouts of bravo when it was over came out of an emotion usually reserved for something more important. Alistair Cook agrees, quote, and then a British crowd forgot its nature. It stood on benches and must have been aware that the deep kind of roar they were making does not belong on any tennis court. It has belonged outside Buckingham Palace the night war was declared. Ned Potter, simply puts down some shorthand in his notebook. B for budge, FH for forehand, pass, lovely, 7:23 p.m.
Don Budge went on from that match to win the Grand Slam, and he was celebrated back in the U.S. as the greatest athlete of his time. Gottfried von Kramm was much less fortunate. Describe what happened to him after he returned to Germany.
Well, yes, after the match, first of all, he embarked on an 8-month world tour. He came to the U.S. for the first time and moved on to Japan, went down to Australia for the Australian Championships, and finally returned to Germany the next March after 8 months abroad, and was immediately arrested, charged with moral delinquency and homosexual acts, and was sentenced to jail for a year. Now, he got a pretty light sentence. His family was very well connected. His mother had a personal audience with Goering to try to get his favor, and in fact, it appears that Goering did intercede a bit. So he was not deported to the camps, as most homosexuals were. He was sentenced to a year in a jail in Berlin, and he was let out early after 8 months. So really, relatively, he got off very easy. But it ruined his career. When he got out, he went back to playing tennis. And in 1939, it was really his chance to win Wimbledon because Budge had turned pro. Von Kramm, most people thought, was the greatest amateur now. He was playing great. He went to England, won the Wimbledon tune-up tournament at Queen's Club. But Wimbledon would not allow him into the draw because he was a convict. He was an ex-con. He had been arrested on a morals charge. And even though it was the Nazis who had done it, to their great shame, Wimbledon would not allow him to enter.
In 1937, tennis was at least as popular as any sport in the United States, as well as in England and Germany. That is no longer the case. Can you imagine a story as dramatic and compelling as the one you tell transpiring today?
I guess you could imagine it, but no, it certainly is very unlikely. Tennis was much more popular than it is now, but also the Davis Cup within tennis, the Davis Cup was much, much bigger. It was the biggest prize in tennis. And not only that, but you had so much riding personally behind the match. You know, last year's Wimbledon final, for example, between Federer and Nadal was just an unbelievable tennis match. But there was nothing really that important riding on it. It was just a couple of millionaires, you know, trying to win again. When you think about this match, they were playing for so much more, and especially von Kramm, who knew what the stakes were for him personally and politically.
Marshal John Fisher is the author of A Terrible Splendor, Three Extraordinary Men, A World Poised for War, and The Greatest Tennis Match Ever Played. The book is published by Crown. Marshal John Fisher joined me from the studios of WAMC. Thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill. It was fun.
My conversation with Marshal John Fisher about his new book, A Terrible Splendor, Three Extraordinary Men, A World Poised for War, and The Greatest Tennis Match Ever Played, will be featured on this week's program. As the NBA's postseason begins, I'll be speaking with Kevin Hench about which teams are best prepared to advance into May and then June. And we'll have a story about the Orlando Magic, which stands a better chance than several to be among those aggregations. I'll be speaking with Edwin Appel, for whom Monday's Boston Marathon will be a cinch compared to some of the other marathons he's already endured in all sorts of places around the world. And we'll have a story about mixed martial arts as they are practiced by high school athletes, kids who don't necessarily get to adopt threatening nicknames and bounce off cages as part of the deal. So join us, and remember, you can always listen to the program at onlyagame.org.